Rise to Rebellion, Disc 11.
The boat slipped silently through black water. The oarsmen practiced at cutting the surface with no sound, pulling the boat in slow rhythm away from the wharf. Behind him, Revere could see the steeple of the church framed against a starry sky. There would be no mistaking the light of the lantern against the darkness. The signal would come from the base of the steeple. He will be there, he thought. He's a good man. I know he understands the importance. Now he turned to the front, steadied himself with both hands on the rail of the small boat. The oarsman said nothing, kept steadily at his work, and Revere could see the moon just rising out to the east, a bright spray of light across the harbor, broken only by the British warships. He felt the excitement now, and looked to the west toward the mouth of the Charles, saw one shape looming large, the moonlight now reflecting off three tall masts. It was His Majesty's ship, a grand man-of-war called the Somerset. Revere glanced at the oarsman, could see a smile, a slow nod. Yes, young man, we are very close to a great deal of trouble. The small boat slipped slowly past the great ship, and Revere could hear sounds now. Voices, the crew of the massive ship right above him, the night watch, perhaps, enjoying the peaceful evening, guarding against nothing, nothing that could keep their army from crossing this bay. No, we cannot stop you, but we can make your secret no secret at all. In moments the Somerset was behind them, and he could hear the oarsmen breathing, small grunts, the young man tiring. He wanted to help, but the man had been very clear, sit tight, no motion to alert the lookouts on the big ship. They reached the far bank now, and Revere was surprised to hear a harsh whisper, someone waiting for him.
Aye, easy now, there you go.
The boat slid to a halt against hard sand, and Revere stood, felt a hand on his arm, helping him from the boat, a face in the dark, a short, round man, the voice unfamiliar.
Welcome to Charlestown, Mr. Revere.
Revere cringed at the volume, the man showing no fear of the sound, and the man now reached into his pocket, handed something to the young man who still sat with his oars. The round man said something, a thank you, and Revere wanted to quiet him, looked back nervously at the great ship coming alive with the glow of moonlight. The man began to speak again, another enthusiastic greeting.
Glad to have you here, sir.
Sir, please, lower your voice. The man turned, guffawed.
Mr. Revere, you are not in Boston now. There's no danger here.
There was more laughter now, calls of greeting, and Revere looked up past the sandy bank, could see bits of reflection, glimpses of faces. He realized the shoreline was alive with men. And suddenly he saw one clear reflection, sharp, metallic, yes, men with guns.
Come now, Mr. Revere, we've got your horse right up this away.
Revere followed the man up the low slope. I must wait for the signal. There can be no mistake. They crested the hill, and the man said,
Signal from whom?
Revere looked back across the water, could see the church steeple framed clearly in the moonlight. There, the church. I cannot leave just yet. I have to know by which route the troops are marching.
Whatever you say, Mr. Revere. Here she be now, your mount, Brown Beauty.
He moved to the horse, could tell she was tall, heavy, well fit for a good hard ride. He patted her neck, still stared at the distant steeple, thought, Please don't fail me, sir. Surely he understands. There was a speck of light now at the base of the tall steeple, and he stared hard, the voices around him now falling silent. One man said quietly,
Is that what you've been waiting for? What does it mean, sir?
He held up a hand, said nothing, waited. Saw now a second speck, a second lantern in the high window of the church, like two small eyes in the dark, unblinking, staring out toward him in the cold moonlight. He felt a great burst of energy, climbed the horse. It means, gentlemen, that you had best advise your men here to stand away. With all respect to you, sir, this is not a fight you want. You could have several hundred soldiers landing on your shore. Two lights, the signal that the British are coming this way, by water. The moonlight opened the roads in front of him, a wide, bright path. The horse took his every command, did not hesitate, and together they pushed past farmhouses, each one hearing his quick shout to rise and be ready. all along the roads. Doors opened, window curtains were pulled back, the farmers and villagers coming awake to the sharp call that a great force of soldiers was marching their way. As he passed, each house rolled into life. Muskets were pulled down from stone hearths, slid out from under beds, retrieved from closets. The men had drilled and planned for this moment for many months. And now they dressed in the dark as their wives pulled together a knapsack, a bit of food, perhaps, bread or dried meat, laid out on the table beside a powder horn. It took barely a minute, and with a last soft word, the men were out of their houses, moving into the road, following the tracks of the horsemen who woke them, knowing only that the tracks led to Lexington. Chapter 29. Pitcairn. The Road to Lexington, April 19th, 1775. The men had been assembled near their camps before midnight, forming as quietly as can be expected of 600 men. They had marched the short distance to the waiting longboats, expecting to cross the mile and a quarter stretch of the bay, but before the first oarsman began his work, Pitcairn was forced to accept what every officer learns, that not every military plan is destined to run with efficiency. As the troops crowded into the boats, Pitcairn realized that they were too many for the boats provided. No one had thought to check with the naval officer in charge whether they had the right number of boats for the number of troops. He had reached the far shore only to sit and wait on his horse with boiling frustration while the longboats had gone back to Boston to load the men left behind. It had been the first great delay. The first troops who had reached the northern shore had been made to stand in formation for nearly 2 hours, and once the remaining men had arrived and the entire force was prepared to move, they were distributed a day's cooked rations. Pitcairn had watched the work of the quartermasters with outraged disbelief, another delay caused by someone neglecting to handle this small but crucial detail, which should have been done while they were still in Boston. When the order came, finally, for the troops to march, they had been ordered away from a plank bridge, their commander fearing that the sound of boots on wood would awaken the neighboring citizens, giving alarm of the movement of the troops. The men instead had to push through the icy chill of waist-deep water, a slow and demoralizing beginning for a force of men who already understood that this night would pass without any sleep. Pitcairn was still not completely sure why he was part of this mission. He was the only Marine present, and even the most discreet officers around him had commented that there were many officers who had a closer relationship with the units on the march who could have performed the job with ability. The overall commander was Lieutenant Colonel Francis Smith, an older man whose ample waistline had given rise to many unkind nicknames. Smith was a reasonably capable man who inspired little actual enthusiasm, and Pitcairn had overheard one injudicious comment from a gathering of junior lieutenants that General Gage had sent the Marine so that there would be at least one officer on the mission who could ride as quickly as the foot soldiers could march. He was grateful for the moonlight, rode near the front of the column, kept an ear open for the instructions of the local guides. He had not seen Colonel Smith for a while, the commander content to allow his men to precede him, and as the troops moved deeper into open countryside, Pitcairn had focused more on roads and intersections than on his commanding officer, making sure the lead of the column marched in the right direction. He crested each hill with a sharp eye, had moved farther to the front, away from the main body. The lead scout troops had spread out slightly off the road, moving quietly, with as much stealth as possible, seeking out anyone who might be attempting to block their march, or, worse, some farmer with a musket who might decide that killing a British soldier made for good sport. Even before the troops had boarded the longboats, word had come back to headquarters that Boston was alive with news of their mission. It had been a shock to Pitcairn, and one more symbol of the frustration of the duty in this miserable place. It was bad enough that so many of the citizens hated their existence, but it was intolerable to Pitcairn's pride in his professionalism that military secrets were paraded through town on the back of every newspaper boy. The order from Smith was still in effect, a silent march. As much stealth as possible, as though the element of surprise was an asset they could depend on. Pitcairn stopped his horse now, could hear sounds rolling across the dark hills in front of them, the men around him hearing as well, muttering their own comments. The first sound had been a church bell. A single chime, followed a minute later by several more. He had felt curious about that. Odd that any church would be calling anyone to services this late. But as the same sounds echoed farther away, he had understood, of course. It was a signal. As they marched farther from Boston, there had been more church bells, long litanies, some even tolling as the column moved past them, whoever might be inside the church, ignoring any threat that the soldiers might attempt to silence the chimes. On the far hills he had begun to hear small bursts of musket fire, but the distance was far too great for them to be a threat to the column. It was another form of signal, protest perhaps, and he stared ahead to the moonlit road with a growing sense of dread. For all the trouble, the inconvenience, the inefficiency of marching at night, nothing at all had been gained. He tried to force himself away from his growing doubts, assured himself, "It is of no consequence that they know we are here. We are too many and too strong. And no matter how much noise they make from the protection of the darkness, it is just chatter after all. Nothing will stop us from doing our job. They have never stood up to these soldiers before, and they will not stand up to us today." He could hear a sudden flurry of voices out in front, and now a lantern was lit, and he saw a man pulled down from a horse, a brief fight. He spurred his horse, moved up, saw a civilian held by two soldiers, the man shouting, "By damned, you have no call!" Pitcairn spotted the sergeant, said, "What have we here?" The sergeant prodded the man, roared, "Answer the major. What brings you out on a lonely road in the middle of the night? Mischief, perhaps?" The man struggled against the hold of the soldiers. "I live hereabouts. I have a right to take a ride any time I see fit." The sergeant looked up at Pitcairn. "What do we do with him, sir? He was up to no good, that's a bloody certainty." The man looked at Pitcairn with a hard, sneering grin. "Well, major, you'll be finding out soon enough what mischief is. There's 500 men up the road at Lexington Green just waiting for you. You might as well turn this parade of lobsterbacks and march him back to Boston." Pitcairn said nothing, thought, "Mischief indeed." He knew we were out here before he ran into us, and he probably knows why we're here. The sergeant still looked up at him.
"Sir, maybe we should tie him to a tree. Keep him out of trouble."
There was laughter from the other troops, and the man said,
"You'll be laughing mighty hard once you run into Sam Adams."
Pitcairn thought, "That's what we're counting on, sir. Though it is within my power, I am not disposed to begin shooting spies this night. Sergeant, have you men escort this gentleman to the rear of the column? He will be our guest for the rest of the march. Sir, since you have been so generous in offering us information about what lies ahead in Lexington, I am pleased to return the favor. There is a great deal more on this road than a parade. There is the entire might of His Majesty's Empire. Even if I believed your ridiculous claim, no 500 men on this earth can stand up in the face of that. Once the sun has come up, you will be released. At that time, I would suggest you go on back to your home." The soldiers led the man back to the tail of the main column. Pitcairn ignored the man's cursing, pointed now to the lantern, prompting the sergeant to say, "The light, Jenkins!" It was suddenly very dark, and Pitcairn warned, "Keep a sharp eye out, Sergeant. If they are nothing else, they are alert."
"Did you believe him, sir? Pardon me, sir, but you think there's 500 waiting for us?"
500 what, Sergeant? Cows? Farmers with pitchforks? Move out now, keep a sharp eye. Any more like him, make sure they're disarmed, then send them to the rear." The march had gone too slowly for his impatience, and he had finally gone back to find Smith. There was no effective way to simply speed up the column, so Pitcairn secured Smith's permission to move forward with a select few companies, about a fourth of the total force. He had spoken to more colonists the sergeant had captured, and the amazing claims of the catastrophe that waited for them had grown. One man insisting that more than 1,000 well-armed militia stood guard at the small town. The scout troops had grown used to the spectacular claims by now, treated the prisoners more as entertainment than any danger to the army. Pitcairn glanced behind him more often now, expected to see the sky lighten, knew that the sunrise was close. The advance guard was still on the alert, and he rode up near them, the rest of his select force close behind. He heard the now familiar pattern, a single set of hoofbeats, the soldiers surging into the road behind a man, grabbing the reins, but the sounds were different this time. No lantern was lit, just shouts and curses. The hoofbeats came again, a hard gallop moving away. He spurred the horse, reached the troops in the road, and the sergeant said, "Sorry, sir, missed that one. He must have gotten wind of us. His horse was spooky, turned away before we could get close enough." Pitcairn stared ahead down the road. "No matter, Sergeant. The guides say we're nearly at Lexington. It will be daylight soon. There's not much that man will tell anyone that they won't see for themselves. Keep your men in the road. Let's make good time." He rode back to the head of the tight column, saw one of the guides, a loyalist farmer named Langston. Behind the column, Pitcairn could see a soft, grey glow, the road now visible by more than moonlight. "How much farther, Mr. Langston?" Langston pointed ahead.
"No farther, Major. We're there."
Pitcairn looked again to the front, could actually see the dark figures of the advance guard gathered in the road, looking back at him. He moved the horse, saw the sergeant waiting for him, and the man simply pointed ahead. Pitcairn spurred the horse gently, moved beyond the advance of the troops, could see the trees clearing away, after them a wide stretch of open ground. Out past the last of the trees, the road fell away in a gentle slope, then divided. On either side, the small buildings, homes, businesses, spread apart with the two branches of the road. He still moved forward, could see between the roads now the dawn spreading a faint light on a wide patch of flat ground, a green wedge that grew wider as the roads led away. He stopped the horse now, could see motion, realized there was a line of men stretching across the center of the open green. Other men on horses were easing up beside him, and he said quietly, "Order the column to halt." He could hear the horses moving away, the officers giving the command, the steady tramp of footsteps growing silent. He felt a knot growing in his chest. Stared ahead, saw more men emerging from a building to one side of the road, running now, joining, lengthening the line. He could feel his men close behind him now, some officers, and he did not look back. Still stared at the green. "Inform Colonel Smith. We have encountered resistance. Order the column into battle line." Beside him he heard the voice of the sergeant, the man laughing.
"Not exactly 500, eh, sir?"
Pitcairn still watched the green, said nothing, thought, "Now 40, perhaps, and 40 muskets. Put your men into line, Sergeant. Mind them." He turned now, saw some faces staring at the scene in front of them, some faces watching him. The officers began directing, the orders familiar from weeks of drill. The men began to flow out away from the road, three lines, one behind the other. He looked at the officers, each one waiting for his instructions. "No one shall fire unless fired upon. Do you understand?" The response was quick, precise.
"Sir, yes, sir."
"Be sure the men understand as well." He turned his horse, faced the green again, could hear the rising voices of his men, a roar of cheering, shouts, and calls as each man took his place in formation. It was the tradition. Cheer your own. Let the enemy know you're ready for the good fight. He stared at the line of civilians standing in tight formation across the green, could not help a smile, was suddenly feeling very good. The confidence of a professional who knows he commands the field, who knows his is the advantage. How long will it take, he thought. How much arrogance do they have to stand up there as though they intend to make a fight against this army? What do we call them, a mob? Rebels? He was still smiling, glanced up at the grey sky. No, they can see us. They know what we have brought. And still they stand there defiant. It is almost comical. The lines behind them were now spread wide, and he looked out in both directions, saw the officers before their men, all looking at him. We do not have time for this, he thought. If Lexington knew to expect us, then Concord will as well. We cannot allow them time enough to move their arsenal. If these people will simply stand aside and let us pass. He pulled at the reins, moved the horse out to one side, beyond his left flank, pulled his pistol from its holster.
Forward!
The lines began to move in precise sequence. No waver, the perfection of so much training, the cheers and calls of his men filling the dawn. He watched the rebels, still standing in the green. His own men, closer still, could see across the way one man suddenly breaking out of the rebel line, running. His men picked up the call, the cheers louder, and now more men began to break away from the line of ragged militia. He did not cheer with his men, still stared at the uneven row of muskets, the rebels who did not run. He raised his arm now, and the officers shouted out, halting the troops. The two sides were barely 40 yards apart, and Pitcairn saw one man standing apart on the far end of the ragged line, older, staring back at him with grim anger. Pitcairn had a sudden curiosity. Perhaps he is their commander. He wanted to know who this man was, to talk to him, to ask him, why? How did you come to be in command of this rabble? No, there will be time for that later when he is in a cell in Boston. He scanned the line of civilians, appraised the muskets, saw the faces of each man, some looking at him, many more staring at the soldiers who faced them. He saw some fear now, but not in all of them. And he waited for the voices of his men to grow quiet, the taunts and cheers fading away. There was a moment of strange silence. Both sides, staring into the muzzles of the other. And Pitcairn felt a hard pounding in his chest, shouted out,
"You will lay down your arms and disperse immediately."
There were responses. Shouts from the civilians, his own troops joining in, and he shouted again, "Rebels, disperse! Lay down your arms!" He looked again at the man on the end of the rebel line, saw the man raise his hand, saw him speaking. He tried to hear the man's order, saw the rebels on that end of the line looking at the man, the muzzles of their muskets dropping down. Pitcairn's chest was still pounding, and he nodded. Pitcairn's chest was, "Good, if you command them, then command them wisely. There must be no blood here." More of the civilians were lowering their muskets, some beginning to move away. The line was broken now, the men in small groups, some standing alone, but gradually they were all spreading apart, moving toward the edge of the green. Beside him, his men began to call out again, a steady stream of taunts and curses. And he wanted to stop them, tell them, "No, it is over. If they disperse now, we can move on our way." He watched several of the civilians moving away, some backing off, watching their enemy carefully, some dragging muskets behind them in dejected defeat. He noticed the onlookers for the first time. Spectators spread all along the far side of the green, some women, even children, some embracing their men as they left the green. Beyond, he saw men standing in the doorway of a house, and suddenly there was a flash of light, and he could see the musket, one man aiming from the corner of the house. There was no sound of a shot, and he tried to see the man, thought, "A flash in the pan, but we should pursue him." And now more sounds came, scattered and distinct, musket fire from beyond the green. His horse suddenly staggered, and he looked down, saw a squirt of blood on the animal's neck, saw a man in line beside him go down. The voices had stopped, and even the civilians who still stood across from him seemed confused, men looking around, searching for the source of the sounds. Down the line he heard a shout, an order, one of his officers, "Fire! Fire, damn you!" Suddenly the line of British muskets exploded into flame, and smoke, a solid burst pouring their shot into the men who still stood across the green from them. His horse reared back, and he gripped the reins. "Do not fire!" he yelled, but his voice could not rise above the screams from the men who fell on the green. Across the green, the onlookers began to scream as well, some running in panic. The fog of grey smoke drifted across, and he could only see glimpses of the civilians.
"No, do not fire!"
But down the line, the officers were closer to their men, firing their own pistols, their men pouring out their hatred, the months of boredom and abuse from the colonists now exorcised through the muzzles of their muskets. The volley was uneven now, scattered, soldiers loading, firing at will. He began to ride, moving between the lines, could see one rebel lying in the grass face down, blood on the man's back. Beside him, another man was sitting, bloody hands holding a wound. The musket fire slowed now, and the voices came back, and it was not the cheers and taunts, it was something new. Women screaming, some running into the green, falling into the arms of their husbands. More voices, cries and curses from the men who were still trying to get away, to escape the blood spreading on the green. He shouted again at his men, waved his pistol high, and finally his voice was heard, the soldiers obeying, the muskets falling silent. He had waited for Colonel Smith. The rest of the column finally arriving in Lexington in time to push the march forward. The civilians had mostly stayed beside the roads, but there was no fight in them, just stunned sorrow at the death that spread across the green. At least 8 men were dead. More were badly wounded. By the time Smith's column absorbed Pitcairn's men into their ranks, the bodies of the rebels had been dragged away, some to their homes, trailed by the devastating grief of their women, some into the tavern close by. With Smith organizing the troops and the townspeople focused on the tragedy, Pitcairn had quietly sent out a patrol, a discreet attempt to accomplish at least one part of the mission. But the reports came back as he expected. Sam Adams and John Hancock had long gone. The sun was behind them, just above the hills, the morning still holding the chill of the April night. He could see clearly now, and on hills on both sides of the road, on every crest, on every open spot of high ground, men were gathering, a hostile audience to the march. The advance guard was out in the road, no need for stealth now. They were scanning not only the hills to both sides, but also the road in front, should rebels suddenly appear there. Each curve in the road, each slight rise, might reveal a human obstruction, another row of muskets. Pitcairn moved close behind them, could feel the column pressing from behind. He probed the wound on the horse, found a second one, but both were minor, the blood already clotted dry. He thought of the soldier who had gone down, only a minor wound, the man still in the march somewhere, farther to the rear. He tried not to think about the chaos, the uncontrollable horror of an army whose discipline fails. They knew their orders, but no one could stop the instinct. He was certain the musket fire had come from beyond the green, a long distance away, the minor wound in the horse's side, testament to that. The rebels were, after all, right there, right in front of me. There will be some questions, that is for certain. General Gage will want to know precisely what occurred. He remembered the flash of light, the misfire. That was it, he thought. That was all it took. One fool. One hot-headed coward who would not stand tall, who did not have the courage to march into the green, and a few others like him back behind some tree, the coward's way. Well, it was not our doing. No responsibility will come to us for that skirmish. It was the work of cowards. He had learned the name of the rebel commander, Captain John Parker, a veteran of the French and Indian War. So now he betrays all he fought for, leads a ridiculous band of rebels who stand up in defiance of the crown. At least he had the wisdom not to fight us this day. His friends probably do not believe it, but by his restraint he is a hero. He could have ordered his men to fire if there had truly been a fight, whether the musket or the bayonet. We might have killed every one of them. Now they are out there, scattered on the hills, following us, watching us. And they must still believe they can stand up to us. The march to Concord was barely 6 miles, and he could see the town now, another gathering of small buildings, homes, and shops. Beyond, there was a river crossed by two bridges, one to the right, north of the town, the other behind the town, more to the south. The guides had given him the location of Barrett's farm, where the munitions were stored, and he pulled the horse to the side of the road, motioned behind him for his aid. "Send for Colonel Smith. The officers should assemble here." The troops were close by, the column keeping a tight formation, every weary soldier aware of the rebels who lined the hills. As the men moved past, Pitcairn waited for the officers to gather, looked for one man in particular, saw him now, the man's wide girth spilling over both sides of the straining horse. "Colonel Smith, Concord awaits us." Smith studied the town, looked around him now, scanned the gathering officers. "Captain Parsons, are you familiar with the geography here?" Parsons was a young, eager man who carried the unhidden ambition of an officer expecting great rewards for his service. He exaggerated his salute. "Oh, quite, sir. I have consulted with the guides, made my own map. Here." He pulled a folded paper from his coat pocket. Smith continued. "Yes, Captain, I have seen a map. Barrett's farm lies northwest of the town beyond the river. You will command three companies to search that place for the powder stores of the rebels. Any you may find are to be put to the torch." "Yes, sir." "Captain Lorry, you will lead three additional companies and take up position at that north bridge and secure the crossing for Captain Parsons' return. The southern bridge is of less concern, but I suppose one company should occupy that to prevent any rebels from annoying us from that direction. I will lead the remainder of the column and occupy the town itself." Smith looked at Pitcairn now. "Anything you care to add, Major?" "We must avoid bloodshed, gentlemen. Keep tight control on your men." Smith sniffed. "Perhaps, Major, but I am of a mind to teach these rebels a lesson."
"Sir, our orders were explicit."
"I know our orders, Major."
Smith scanned the faces of the officers.
"We will discuss this at another time. I do not expect any of His Majesty's soldiers to shirk from a confrontation. If the rebels insist on facing us in battle line, they should expect the consequences."
Pitcairn wanted to argue, but Smith turned his horse, the discussion over. Pitcairn nudged the horse gently, followed Smith, moved alongside him now, said quietly, "Colonel, if we engage the rebels, it could well start a war. It is not in our orders."
"Major! The war was started by the Sons of Liberty the first time they violated the King's edicts. It does not take blood to make a war." "I am surprised at you, Major. A man with your experience, a Marine no less, should not even be questioning this. We are operating under instructions to seize and destroy rebel arms. Anyone who stands in our way is subject to immediate imprisonment. Capturing armed men must certainly involve using arms ourselves. What does war have to do with any of this? General Gage would quite agree with me, I'm certain."
"Yes, sir." Pitcairn stopped the horse, watched Smith move away, thought, "I'm not so sure about that, Colonel. General Gage has done everything in his power to avoid a war." He turned, could see the other officers still gathered in place, waiting for the final order to begin dispersing the troops. He rode toward them, heard Parsons boast,
"We'll be sitting pretty in Boston when this day is through."
Pitcairn moved up close to the others, couldn't help a strange, nervous feeling in his gut.
"You have your orders. Proceed."
The officers moved away. Instructions shouted out in crisp detail, sergeants pulling their men together. The column began to divide, the selected companies moving out in separate directions, the men on horseback directing the flow. He moved out to the right of the column, rode a short way into a field of green grass, could see the river clearly, a sharp bend away to the north, and just to the right of the bend, an arching bridge. Beyond the bridge, a small group of rebels had gathered. He muttered to himself, "No, move away. Don't attempt such foolishness again. Can't you see us? The numbers, the strength, we will not be stopped." Parsons was already on the move, his men in line, marching down the long slope toward the bridge. Behind them, Lorry was still forming the other troops who would hold position around the bridge. Pitcairn nudged the horse again.
moved alongside the column, could see the rebels backing away from the bridge now, felt relief.
Yes, use wisdom.
His uneasiness had faded, the confidence returning. We will do our job, and no ragtag bunch of militia will slow us down. He watched the rebels as they scampered away up another long rise, a wide crest beyond the river. There were a few houses scattered along the crest, farm buildings spread out all along the higher ground. The rebels were nearly out of sight now, and Parsons' troops had reached the bridge, were moving across. The sound of footsteps now broke the quiet, and he watched Parsons waiting on the far side of the river, urging his men across, faster, the mission awaiting them. The column was soon clear of the bridge, moving away, following the course of the river. He thought of the map. Barrett's farm, not far. They should be there in a few minutes. To find what? It has taken too much time. Surely the rebels know why we're here, have already moved their powder. He shook his head. No, it doesn't matter. We will complete the job, march back to Boston by nightfall. He thought of Gage now, the man's frustration at doing this job. It is not my place to question his decisions. It is a fragile situation, and unlike Colonel Smith, I do not believe you can have a war with no bloodshed. Those men who died in Lexington, certainly they will have their hue and cry, but if we are fortunate, nothing more will come of it. Let us march these men back to Boston and try to forget this day ever happened. The second column had reached the bridge, one company crossing over, moving out into the wide open field, facing up toward the crest, the farmhouses. He began to move the horse closer to the river, then heard a shout, saw an officer pointing toward the town. He looked in that direction, saw a column of black smoke, pulled the horse that way. They must have found something. Well, very damned good. Let's find something worth burning and then leave this place behind. He crossed the road that led down to the bridge, climbed a short rise near a large house, saw faces hiding behind curtains as he passed. He reached a vantage point, could see out over the town. The smoke was still thick and black, and he could not yet identify the source. Colonel Smith is there, but perhaps I should find out just what they're doing. He heard more shouts now, back at the bridge, turned, saw the men on the north bridge suddenly moving, scrambling into a tight line. He stared out across the river, beyond the wide field, up the long hill. All along the crest, there was now a solid line of dark motion emerging from the farmhouses. He began to move the horse back toward the bridge, to where his men were now standing hard in a new line of battle, staring, as he was, at the mass of men gathering on the crest, gradually forming their own line. He tried to see details. The long line on the crest, growing now, still too far away to see clearly, but now the sun caught the reflections, and he could tell there were muskets, a great many muskets. He felt an icy stab in his chest, saw the mass begin to move forward now, an uneven advance coming at them slowly down the hill, and now he heard new sounds, music, the fife and drum. All along the crest, the rebel line was still forming, massing more tightly as they moved forward, precise, an amazing display of drill and command. As they advanced down the hill, he could see the men themselves, and it was not like the green at Lexington. It was not 40 men. It was 400. He watched as Laurie's soldiers on the far side of the bridge pulled back across, forming a battle line along the edge of the river. He knew Walter Laurie, knew the man's weakness could be the inexperience of an officer who has never seen an enemy. Now they faced him, and Laurie had placed one company, 45 men, in position to receive the rebels should they attempt to cross the bridge. The other two companies were in close formation right behind them. Pitcairn was still riding toward the bridge, saw an aide riding hard away toward the town. Yes, good. It will be Laurie's request for reinforcements. The smoke still billowed in a black column in the town, and he knew that Smith might have some problems of his own, might be facing a force just like the one that was now forming up by the far side of the bridge. Still, if there is to be trouble, it might be over something as absurd as who controls this one bridge. But Captain Parsons is out there in the countryside somewhere, and we cannot just abandon him. We have to make a way for him to get back. He spurred the horse, felt more of an urgency now, saw nothing moving from the town. The three companies at the bridge were holding their ground, the only sound, the strange fife and drum from the rebels. He could see the soldiers holding tight in line, motionless, thought of Laurie's inexperience. No, it's not a good position. He should back us away a bit, spread them out more. We're too bunched up at the bridge. Still, it could be a deterrent if the rebels try to cross. Suddenly, the music stopped, and he held up the horse, a cold breath of deathly calm drifting over the open ground. He felt a twist of fear, glanced across the empty ground toward Concord, saw nothing, no reinforcements. There may not be enough of us if they mean to come across. Suddenly, there was a burst of musket fire, and it was not the rebels, it was Laurie's men, the front line facing the bridge. Pitcairn felt a cold shock, paralyzed, a scream of horror in his brain. No, you must not! And now the response came. A great burst of fire and smoke, the rebel line erupting in a volley of their own. The bridge was bathed in white smoke, and the soldiers fired again, another volley, but there was little precision, the shots coming in scattered bursts. The rebels fired a second time, some precision still, but then all order was gone, the scene engulfed in a vast fog, shouts and screams blending with the hard pops and chatter of the muskets. He stared at the great cloud of smoke, felt completely helpless. The battle roaring in front of him, could see soldiers suddenly flooding back away from the bridge, the order and precision of the troops wiped away by the sudden terror of a fight they could not win. He spurred the horse, raised his pistol, shouted, "No, hold the line! Stand firm!" The troops were rolling past him now, a panic he had never before seen, and he screamed at them to halt, to form and fire. Along the bridge, the smoke had begun to drift away, and he could see the rebels swarming across, the last of the soldiers now in full, scrambling retreat, the ground at the bridge littered with grotesque heaps of red. He pointed his pistol at the mass of rebels now spreading out on the near side of the bridge, fired, the pistol jumping in his hand. His own voice screamed at him inside his head, "Too far away! Do your damned job! Form the men!" The soldiers had slowed the retreat, some of the men coming back into line behind him, but not all of them. Too many were still moving away, pursued by their own shock, the awful horror of the unexpected, leaving their own dead and wounded behind. Pitcairn stared down at the bridge, saw the rebels were not pursuing, were content to hold their position. He backed away now, moved with the troops, glanced toward the town, saw nothing, no motion. The reinforcements not coming. Saw the fat old figure of Smith in his mind. Damn him! The musket fire had stopped, and now there was a new sound coming from the bridge. The sound of men cheering. The rebels suddenly erupting in a wild celebration of their victory. Pitcairn began to wave his sword, but the energy was gone. The fight and his men drained away by the deadly shock that these rebels, this ragtag militia, had faced the king's soldiers and had driven them away. Colonel Smith had tried to bring the reinforcements to the North Bridge himself, but the troops could only move as quickly as their rotund commander, and so by the time any British troops could be formed to face the rebels, it was clear even to Smith that there was nothing more to be done. All along the hills around Concord, rebel militia continued to arrive, some as well organized as the advance to the North Bridge, the numbers growing by the hour. The rebels had moved away from the bridge itself, and Parson's men had been able to pull back, recrossing the North Bridge without opposition. The mission to Barrett's farm had unfolded as Pitcairn had expected, with little in the way of munitions to be found. In the town itself, the troops had burned a blacksmith shop, accidentally setting fire to the small courthouse. But there was no armed resistance there either, and the officers themselves had wisely ordered their men to assist in extinguishing the fires. By midday, neither Smith nor Pitcairn had any reason to keep their troops at Concord. The only priority now was to make the return march to Boston. Pitcairn had placed a rear guard to protect the last of the column, and for the first mile away from Concord there had been no trouble, no close pursuit. The column reached an intersection known as Merriam's Corner, turned southeastward, the road that would take them back through Lexington. Pitcairn stayed back near the rear guard, the men marching with muskets ready, their faces staring down, not seeming to believe that this morning had truly occurred. He had tried to talk them up, words of encouragement, and they answered him in polite response, but he understood that these men were marching back to Boston, wearing the awful shroud of defeat. He swung the horse out to the side of the column and looked up toward the front, could see a mass of woods narrowing in on the road, thought, "Perhaps I should move up, ride with Colonel Smith. We should plan for some possible resistance again when we reach Lexington." He glanced back at the guard to the rear, and suddenly there was a dull pop, then another. He looked for the sound, saw the soldiers up ahead breaking the line, a few spilling off the road. Now there were more sounds of musket fire, and he felt his heart jump in his chest. Scattered through the woods, he could see flashes of fire, small clouds of smoke filling the spaces. He felt a raw fury exploding in his brain. "Damn them! Enough of this! We will kill them right here!" He began to shout, "Form in place! Advance into the trees! Use the bayonet!" The men near him rushed forward, picking their way into the woods, and the cacophony of musket fire grew. His men were shouting on their own now, anger and frustration pulling them deeper into the woods. He spurred the horse, would follow them, the mind of the officer fighting through his own fury. "We cannot get them all, but we can take prisoners. Grab what we can," he shouted again. "Capture them! Take prisoners!" His men took up the call, pushing deeper into the woods, the rebels' muskets silent now. He ducked his head, passed under a low limb, was moving through his own men, could see motion in front of him, the rebels running away. He noticed the trees thinning out, the ground opening into a wide field. He surged out into the clearing, his men behind him, saw the rebels running across the open ground. "Damn you! Now we will have you!" His men took up the call again, but there were too few soldiers, most still back in the woods, the exhaustion slowing their pursuit, holding them closer to the road. The rebels disappeared over the crest of a small hill, and he let out a short, cold laugh. "No time for you to reload. I have you now." He stabbed with his spurs, the horse lunging forward, and he reached for one of his pistols, the pair of guns held tightly in their holsters on his saddle. Suddenly there was a blast of fire in front of him, the horse rearing up, his hands slipping from the pistols, and he grabbed for the reins, missed, the horse now surging forward again, driven by its own panic. He fell back, landed hard on the ground, a sharp pain in his side. He tried to see, shouted for the horse, but the animal did not stop, galloped past the rebels, and Pitcairn could only watch as the horse disappeared, the saddle empty of its rider, but still holding the prize of his two pistols. His men were around him now, hands helping him to his feet. He tested his back, his side, the pain not crippling. He wanted to pursue the rebels, order his men to move forward, but the enemy was gone now, vanished into another patch of woods. He brushed away the helping hands, felt the fury again, saw the familiar face of the sergeant who said, "Sir, we can get you a horse straight away, but we had best get back to the road." Pitcairn glanced toward the far woods again, to where his horse had disappeared, his demeanor shattered. "Damn you, you fight like cowards!" The sergeant waited a moment, repeated, "Sir, we'd best be getting back." Pitcairn saw now that there were only a handful of troops, could hear voices back on the road, the column pulling itself back together again. He began to walk, the soreness in his side stabbing him, his own private defeat. "Back to the road! Fall in line!" They rejoined the rest of the column, the men trying to find the rhythm of the march again. Slowly moving forward, and seconds later he could hear the pops again, farther ahead, then suddenly, from the other side of the road, another shot, much closer, one man going down near him. He pointed, "There!" He wanted to order them out again, to pursue the rebel in the woods, but there was only silence there now, the man already gone back into deep cover. The wounded man was being tended to, rose slowly to his feet, blood on his shoulder. The men of the rear guard were watching Pitcairn, waiting for his next order, and he looked toward the front, saw the column still in motion. "We cannot pursue, we must keep moving." All along the road back to Lexington, the thickets of woods were alive with rebels, men firing in quick bursts, then disappearing. From close and far away, the rebels continued to pick and snipe at the march of the soldiers, and if the aim was poor or the shots too distant, there was still a deadly effect. the unlucky soldier suddenly dropping in his tracks, a short scream, perhaps. Or worse, a man collapsing with no sound at all. The disciplined march of the army had become a chaotic horror, the men reacting to every sound, some firing their muskets against the orders of the officers, responding to the ghostly glimpse of a rebel's quick retreat. Pitcairn marched with them, heavy footsteps on a road where every rock, every tree, every farmhouse hid a new danger. By the time the column reached the familiar green of Lexington, exhaustion had blended with terror. Pitcairn had absorbed the mood of the men around him, knew that this could not continue, that if the rebels continued to picket the column with such efficacy, there would be no column at all. These men would become a mob of their own, a panicked scramble back to Boston, to any safety they could find. Beyond the green, the road was suddenly alive with a new sight, new sounds, cheers and calls from a new force. When Pitcairn crossed the open ground, pursued still by the hot zip of the musket balls, he could see a solid line of red spread out as his own men had spread out in the dawn. He knew that early that morning Smith had sent word back to Boston, a message that they had met armed resistance at Lexington. Pitcairn had disregarded its impact, knew that Gage had thought 600 men more than up to the task, that Gage might simply consider Smith to be overly cautious. But Pitcairn realized now that he had been wrong. Gage had responded. He marched with a new energy in his steps toward the astounding sight and had to convince himself, no, it is truly not a mirage, an apparition. It is blessed reinforcements. An entire brigade had marched out of Boston to support the retreat of Smith's column. But the fight was not yet complete. As the British resumed their march to Boston, the rebels still picked and prodded sudden bursts of assault on men who rarely saw their enemy. The British panic grew slowly, began to change in ways that even horrified officers could not avoid. The soldiers began to strike back with animal viciousness, and each house became a target, the troops storming any place that might hide a sniper. The uncontrollable violence intensified with each shot from a hidden musket, and by the time the soldiers finally reached the safety of Boston, they had left in their wake a terror of their own. Citizens who had no part of the day's fight murdered in their homes, houses and farms put to the torch. The rebels did not stop their deadly harassment of the troops until, at long last, with the sun setting over the hills that still held gathering masses of rebel militia, the devastated force of King George's army once again boarded the Navy's longboats and were rowed slowly across the harbor to their camps in Boston. Chapter 30. Gage. Boston, April 21st, 1775. The senior officers filled the office, occupied every space. The talk had rattled on all morning, and he had stayed mostly quiet, had let them blow out their theories, great hot breaths of indignation, small bits of wisdom sprinkled among grand explosions of outright foolishness. He could not help noticing Pitcairn's silence. The man's mood obviously subdued, none of the brash pronouncements that came from the others. Well, of course. What depresses a Royal Marine most of all, the loss of battle or the loss of pride? He could sense the conversation running out of energy, waited a moment longer, the faces beginning to turn in his direction. There you have it, gentlemen, your own demonstration of the obvious. I bring you in here to expose your brilliance, to make the best use of His Majesty's most valued military minds. And what have we decided to do? What one principle have we agreed upon? Since no one advocated outright surrender, I assume we should consider an alternative. I would select one of you to provide a summary. He scanned the faces, saw no one poised to speak out. What? No one to reveal how inept I have been? No one who carries the great weight of the empire on his back, the intelligence of centuries of triumph? No one to reveal the simple solution, or perhaps throw out on this desk the plan that could have averted our present dilemma? He had run out of energy for his own sarcasm now, held up his hands. Anyone. A man stood now, older, the naval uniform unique in the room. Gage glanced at the faces of some of the younger men, saw grimacing telltale hints of dread that the old man should be the spokesman. The old man seemed to puff up, said,
"General Gage, I have fought for the Empire in wars that most of these younger men have only read about. I have felt the rage of His Majesty's warships explode in fire and flame beneath my very boots. The Navy's tradition, Admiral Graves, no one here is unaware of your long and valiant service to the Empire."
Graves was silent for a few moments, then continued.
"As Commander-in-Chief of the Navy's contingent in these waters, I would offer a suggestion."
He pointed out toward one window with a view of the harbor.
"Before the enemy enables themselves to make a powerful defense, we must assault those hills to the north. The Charlestown Peninsula must be cleared of rebels. The danger to the city is significant, General. Rebel artillery placed on those hills could make this position untenable. Since I assume the General does not wish his headquarters reduced to ashes, this action will eliminate that very threat. Once secured, your troops could then assault Roxbury, Cambridge, and any of the other towns where the rebels might make a stand. With the support of my ships, no rebel force near the coast could survive a coordinated assault. With your troops controlling the hills in all directions of Boston, and my ships controlling the harbor and any surrounding territory, Boston will be impregnable, a veritable fortress."
Graves looked around the room, weighing the impressiveness of his plan, then slowly lowered himself to a chair, his satisfaction complete. Gage looked at the faces, was amazed to see nods of agreement.
"Thank you, Admiral. So you would advise that we be absolutely certain to take the steps necessary to demonstrate that we are truly, and without hesitation, engulfed in a state of war?"
He scanned the faces again, saw a few frowns. Now Pitcairn seemed to wake up, glanced at Graves, said,
"What else can it be, General? Surely you have seen the reports. We suffered nearly 300 casualties. Nearly 100 men died. I don't know how many rebels we killed. How can anyone say that we are not now engaged in a war?"
There was heavy sorrow in Pitcairn's voice, and Gage felt his sarcasm slip away. The mood of the room was somber.
"I am not convinced. I refuse to be convinced that we have but one course. I am not concerned that there are those of you in this room who disagree with me, because I am still in command. I am greatly concerned that London may disagree. About that I can do nothing but wait. I understand the value of the Charlestown Peninsula, Admiral. I am grateful that the rebels do not appear to yet have much in the way of artillery to mount a bombardment on us from Breed's Hill, but I can tell you with absolute certainty that we do not have the strength of manpower to carry out any kind of general assault on any well-defended position. Major Pitcairn, you should understand that better than anyone in this room. There are other reports on this desk besides casualties, Major. One is an estimate of the rebel strength that now occupies the ground beyond this town. The rebels were not satisfied by merely harassing and humiliating the King's soldiers. They did not return to their homes safe in the knowledge that this army dare not make any more forays into the countryside. They came to us, gentlemen. They are right out there, a solid line. I myself have heard them digging, and it has convinced me that they plan to stay a while. Whether any of you care to admit it or not, our little contribution to the Empire's history has had a change of course. We are now under siege."
The meeting had broken up, and Gage watched them leave the office with a profound sadness that he himself had felt since the disaster 2 days earlier. Colonel Smith had not even attended the meeting, had requested time to compose letters of sympathy to the families of the dead, a request that Gage had not wanted to grant. He had thought there should be some delay, some time to gather the emotions, to sort out the bits of truth from the loose and angry talk of the men.
but then he had received word from up the coast. A fast packet boat had already sailed for London, and with it went the report from the rebel side of the events of April 19th. It would reach an English people who would soak up the horror of what their soldiers had endured, and worse, the horrors of what the soldiers themselves had done, the animal response to the terror that followed their retreat. No mere military explanation would ever justify the atrocities against the civilians, and no official report written by his office could ever hope to offset the impact that the first accounting of the details would have, especially as written by anyone close to the Sons of Liberty. He stared at the closed door, thought of London, the newspapers, the cries over the fresh bit of news, the scramble of the crowd to read the first words. But it is of no import, really. It can never matter to an army what the people read of death and the bloody hell of war. What matters to a commander is what is said in private, behind those thick walls of government, where men who have too much authority and who are too far away will decide who carries the blame. To anyone who has preached with such certainty how this annoying little rebellion will simply disappear under the heel of our boot, there can be no explanation except failure of command. The decision might already have been made. London is filled with men of great ambition, and whoever makes the best case will certainly find himself boarding a ship. He wanted to look toward the window, scan the harbor, but there was no energy. He still rested heavily in the chair, stared ahead, wondered, who might it be? Who might announce his presence here? And will he do it with grace, as I tried to do with Hutchinson? Or will there be brass bands, an official parade, guards with bayonets to remove me, lest I attempt some resistance? He shook his head, cleared his mind of the ridiculous image. You are still in command, you still have a job to do. You still must convince the ministry that we need more men. There was a faint knock on the door, and Gage stared at the source of the sound for a moment. What is there? The door opened, and he saw Kemble, the young man wide-eyed, one hand pointing discreetly toward the outer office. Sir, you have a visitor. Not now, Major. Have them make an appointment. Sir, it's Dr. Warren. Joseph Warren. Kemble was still pointing, nodding now as though Gage needed convincing, and Gage sat back in the chair, the surprise blossoming in his mind. He gave a small laugh. Well, now, give proper credit to courage. Show him in, Major. The door swung wide, and Kemble stood back, waited as Warren stepped inside the office. Gage motioned to Kemble the familiar order, out, and Kemble's face curled into disappointment as the door closed. Well, the good doctor comes to visit. Is someone ill, or are you here to surrender? Warren stood straight, held his hat in both hands at his waist, said, Surrender whom, sir? Gage laughed, pointed to the closest chair. Of course, we are all innocent men. Please sit down, doctor. Forgive my lack of graciousness. These are not the best of times. Or have you been so consumed by the business of medicine that you have not heard? Warren moved the chair close to the desk. I have heard of great tragedy, General. I feel the need to inform you, sir, that a great many people in Boston are of the belief that there is tragedy still to come. Many of the people here feel considerably endangered. Gage stared at Warren, expecting a smile, but Warren revealed no humor. Endangered by whom, Doctor? It depends, sir, on which people we might refer to. I would refer to several groups, actually, each in its own way. Gage was curious now, began to feel a game brewing. I don't have the patience for riddles, Doctor. Would you care to give me an example?
Well, first there are the private citizens, innocent bystanders, as it were. It may be true that not all of us are as innocent as we would like, but the fact is a great many people in this town are guilty of nothing but their choice of residence.
You may be correct about that, Doctor.
Is there another example? Possibly, General. You have a number of soldiers who may feel somewhat in danger as well. By whom, Doctor? Those rebels out there in the hills? Or are you suggesting that under the right guidance your innocent citizens might somehow cause some trouble of their own? Warren finally smiled. I would never suggest that, sir. Gage's patience was thinning, and he said, What do you want here, Doctor? I admire bravery, and you are brave to show up here, but I do not respect foolishness. And some in my command would consider your visit a foolish mistake, would not resist an opportunity to jail a recognized leader of the rebellion. So are you brave or foolish? General, I am interested in preventing injury to the innocent. On behalf of no one but myself, I am asking that anyone in Boston who wishes to leave be given the opportunity to do so unmolested. You have sealed off the city, and that is a military decision with which, under the present circumstances, I cannot argue. But there is no need to endanger the innocent. And if I allow the citizens to leave, I reduce the risk that someone might be inspired to make an unwise attack on my men. I'm not sure it's a fair trade, Doctor. I rather like having the, innocent under my care. You have a large number of friends surrounding this town who might reconsider some reckless assault of their own if they knew the risk to the civilians. I would never use the word hostage, Doctor, but then I didn't create this crisis. He felt a growing smugness, expected Warren to show something, anger, a glimpse beyond the man's calm. Warren simply shook his head. Hostage is a horrible word, General. But I regret that it is certainly accurate in this case, but I must say it is an equally appropriate description elsewhere. The smugness slipped away, and Gage asked, What do you mean? I am only familiar with those citizens in Boston who wish to leave, who carry no blame of their own, who fear for the safety of their families. However, I have heard rumor, General, that there are a great many people beyond this town who share the same desire, the same fear, except that their particular sense of allegiance brings them to want to come here. Some refer to them as Tories. I have heard that a good many Tories feel the same fear for their safety as the citizens of Boston. You see, General, hostage is hardly a word anyone should be using. I am referring to all of these people, whether in or out of Boston, only as refugees. The game was over, and Gage understood that he held no advantage. He still searched Warren's face for some sign, some betrayal, but Warren had made his case, was simply waiting for Gage's response, a policy decision from the man who supposedly held all the power. He thought a long moment, tried to imagine the outcry in London if the Tories and Loyalists outside of Boston were denied entry to the one place they could find safety. Does it matter if the danger is real? Are the Loyalists any more likely than civilians in Boston to suddenly be dragged from their beds? Neither side would commit such outrageous brutality, and yet... Warren leaned forward slightly, said, General, should I leave you to consider the question further? The question requires no further thought, Doctor. I will allow passage out of the city to anyone who wishes to leave. I will expect the same from your friends in regard to anyone who wishes to come here. Warren smiled again, a long breath of relief. Thank you, General. Frankly, sir, it was the decent thing to do. One more thing, Doctor. One rule. The guns stay here. Sir? The muskets, pistols, anything else your innocent civilians might have in their possession, leave them behind. What would innocent people need with guns, anyway? Warren seemed to digest the point, got up, made a short bow. I will pass the word, sir. Thank you again. Warren opened the door, and Gage watched him leave, saw Kemble peering in, desperate to satisfy his curiosity. Gage waved him away. Close the damn door, Major. He stood now, his legs stiff with tension, moved to the window, stared out at the harbor, the masts of the tall ships, the might of His Majesty's Navy. It will be soon, he thought. Someone will sail in here and announce that I haven't done the job. He will carry a fresh stack of orders from Lord Dartmouth, will be eager to relate how he received such good wishes from the king. He might even have the officers gather, just as I did today, and reveal with that arrogant confidence the plan of action, the answers to all our problems, the grand strategy that, this time, will actually work. Well, good luck to you, sir.
This ends Disc 11.